chance of removing nukes, while that would be fantastic and while I support that, isn't worth what, you know, this Faustian pact with the creation of a new kind of nationalist oil state in Britain. And I would want to refer to one more thing that Billy Bragg was talking about Norway before. Now, Norway is also, I mean, you know, a petrostate. But the thing that fuels Norwegian social democracy is, as well as a very tight and very restrictive and very isolationist immigration policy, is, you know, an enormous amount of oil money. Now, according to calculations, oil reserves are going to start tapering off. This is according to the a particular report produced in Britain, which potentially, you know, is...
Sam, I'm going to have to cut it off there because the show is ending and give Billy Bragg 5 seconds to respond.
I think Sam is a good example of a person on the left who can't get his head around politics in the 21st century. These things are changing and moving on. And if we are to get to grips with international capitalism, then we're going to have to allow people to have self-determination. That's what the referendum is about, not nationalism.
The vote for Scottish independence is on Thursday, tomorrow. That does it for the show. Sam Weatherall, thanks for joining us. Billy Bragg, thank you. That does it for Democracy Now! Our website's democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. Up next, the KBOO Evening News.
Registration is now open for the Pacific Northwest Social Forum coming to Portland the weekend of September 26th through the 28th. The weekend will feature People's Movement assemblies on topics such as treaty rights, food sovereignty, housing justice, and more. The Social Forum will begin Friday, September 26th with the concert by KBOO Station co-manager Mike Crenshaw and friends. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this important and historic event where we, the people, will create the Pacific Northwest Plan of Action for social, economic, and climate justice. Information about registration, endorsement, childcare, or on the Pacific Northwest Social Forum in general can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
John Coltrane. Every September, KBOO Community Radio celebrates the birthday of John Coltrane with an all-night marathon honoring Coltrane's life, his legacy, his influence on musicians around the world, but mostly his music. Tune into KBOO this Friday night, beginning at 10 p.m. as we celebrate John Coltrane's 88th birthday with an 8-hour marathon, rare recordings, interviews, and some new releases. That's this Friday night from 10 p.m. until 6 a.m. Coltrane Night, a September tradition only here on KBOO Portland. And remember to join us the following Tuesday night, September 23rd, John Coltrane's 88th birthday, as KBOO Night at the Clinton features The World According to Coltrane, beginning at 7 p.m. Tuesday night, September 23rd, a celebration of the 88th birthday of John Coltrane.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the House approves funding for U.S. efforts against ISIS.
A wildfire continues to burn near Estacada.
And new information shows significant contributions by Koch Industries in favor of the Oregon top two primary ballot measure.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 17th, 2014. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The House of Representatives has approved $500 million in funding for the arming of Syrian rebels trying to unseat Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The measure passed 273 to 156. It's expected to be taken up in the Senate tomorrow. Representatives who voted no indicated they had doubts over whether Syrian rebels would shift their fight against Assad to take on the Islamic State, the hardline fundamentalist group which has taken over large swaths of Syria and Iraq, and who also engage in fighting against Assad. In the Senate, Secretary of State John Kerry faced questioning today as to who specifically has signed on to an international coalition to fight the Islamic State and exactly what they have committed. At the hearing before the Foreign Affairs Committee, Kerry echoed President Obama, saying ground troops would not engage in combat in Iraq and Syria, contradicting Joint Chiefs of Staff head General Martin Dempsey, who said it remained a possibility. In other news, the Islamic State today released a video threatening to blow up the White House and to kill U.S. troops.
A ballot measure to reform Oregon's primary system has been gathering support from Oregon businesses. Measure 90 would put Republicans and Democrats in the same primary where all voters could vote for their favorite candidate. The top two members would then compete in the general election. The measure has received $100,000 from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Administrators, the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, and other business groups and individuals. Under the current system, independent voters and members of minor political parties can't vote in primary elections. But if Measure 90 passes, all registered voters would be eligible. Supporters of Measure 90 say that it will allow independents and minor party voters to have a bigger voice in elections. But opponents of the measure argue that it can actually disenfranchise voters by splitting the vote of the more popular party, allowing two candidates from the less popular party to run in the general election. The measure will be decided in the November 4th election in Oregon. For more, KBOO's David Lessem spoke with Seth Woolley of the Pacific Green Party.
Just to tell our listeners, what is Measure 90?
Measure 90 is a top two proposal where they changed the primary. So instead of being a partisan primary, they normally get party members choosing who their party nominated person is for the general election. They would put all candidates of every party together in a single primary, and then only the top two candidates in that low turnout primary, generally about half of the voters in the general election participate in that primary, they would pick who the two are that go to the general election. So we would end up not having any independent candidates, basically, in the general election.
Proponents of the measure say that it will increase the power of independent and small political parties by allowing them to participate in elections. How do you feel 90 will affect voters in smaller parties such as the Pacific Green Party?
Well, as the evidence indicates in California and Washington and other places around the world, actually, who've done top two systems, minor party and independent candidates have been eliminated from the general election ballot anytime there has been more than one candidate put up by the major parties, even if there's a place where it's primarily Democrats or primarily Republicans. If two of the candidates are Democrats or Republicans, then minor party and independent candidates are basically kicked out of the election.
Measure 90 has been attracting a lot of business backing. Why does it enjoy so much support from business interests?
Well, if they can, if the business interests can support their candidates early on, which is a good time to get support for candidates, then they don't have to worry about the partisan, the actual members of political parties, which are free associations, deciding who their nominees will be. So if you have a Tea Party person or a progressive or a left progressive, then they don't have to worry about that too much because they can just support two candidates early on with corporate money and the issue is settled. Those are the two that will be selected for the general election.
What is the involvement of the Koch brothers in this measure?
So the Koch brothers have donated money to the Associated Oregon Industries PAC, which is the second largest contributor to the Yes on Measure 90 campaign. And the Koch brothers are the third largest aggregate contributor to the Associated Oregon Industries PAC, behind only Daimler Trucks and Esko Corp. So and there was actually a donation where $50,000 was sent in to the Yes on 90 campaign, the day after $10,000 from the Koch brothers was sent in to Associated Oregon Industries.
As a member of the Pacific Green Party, do you think there are better options for reforming the political system to empower alternative political voices?
Yeah, there are definitely better options. In 1908, actually, we passed a constitutional amendment in Article 2, Section 16 of the Oregon Constitution right after we had passed direct democracy so that all voters could decide direct legislation. And what Article 2, Section 16 allows is proportional representation and ranked ballots, or so-called instant runoff voting, where you can rank your candidates in order of preference, first, second, and third, and so on. And what that would allow the ballot counters to do is to run repeated runoffs, eliminating the last place candidate until somebody gets a majority. And this prevents spoiler issues. What Top 2 does instead is it makes an incentive for people to run ringer candidates of the opposing party to try and split votes and try to get their members through. And we know from experience that right-wing candidates are more likely to be able to retain control over what candidates run. Left parties tend to run more candidates, splitting their vote. And in California, for example, there have been recent cases where two Republicans got in a majority Democrat seat because there were too many Democrats running. So the Democratic district had to choose between two Republicans.
Do you think that choosing Top 2 as opposed to ranked preference in this measure was by design, or do you believe it was an oversight?
I don't think it was an oversight because, well, it's been legal in Oregon, and we could implement it by lobbying. If the corporations wanted fair and majoritarian voting, they could easily have it. They could have specified it directly. Top 2 is designed specifically to help essentially make strengthen the two-party system, which they like, actually. That's one of the reasons we have a two-party system.
What's the impact on fusion voting? The Working Families Party says that it will end the so-called spoiler factor of third parties.
Well, the Working Families Party isn't your typical third party. They like to choose between the two major parties. So the idea that you can put an endorsement on the ballot is appealing to them. But to all other third parties that actually run their own candidates, with all of our candidates eliminated from the ballot, it essentially means we would have to choose between the top two candidates, which would be Democrats and Republicans too. And the whole reason we exist as third parties is because we feel that the Democrats and Republicans aren't providing realistic choices for us, viable choices that represent our values.
My name is David Lessem for KBOO Evening News. I've been talking with Seth Woolley from the Pacific Green Party. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
A wildfire is still raging outside of Estacada today, but fire officials say cooler temperatures and today's high humidity are helping firefighters working to contain the blaze. The 36-pit fire began on Saturday and has caused evacuations and road closures and has burned an estimated 4,000 acres. The fire is approximately 7% contained. No one has yet been injured in the fire, but officials said 168 homes are currently threatened. The First Baptist Church of Estacada is currently sheltering 25 people with support from the Red Cross. 500 firefighters are on hand battling the fire, while another 300 are on their way.
In related news, more than 6,000 firefighters are battling 11 major blazes in California as hot and parched conditions persist in the state. The fires comprise some 190,000 acres and run the length of the state. 3,000 homes and structures are threatened. More than 200 homes have already been destroyed. A large fire in the Klamath National Forest on Oregon's border is threatening 1,000 homes in the town of Weed at the base of Mount Shasta, which has already seen 150 buildings burn as a result of the fire, including the town's library and two churches. A fire in El Dorado County is threatening 2,400 structures.
In 2015, the state of Oregon will increase the minimum hourly wage to $9.25. That's an increase of 15 cents from the current minimum wage. However, even with this increase, workers and their families are still going to struggle to meet basic needs. Reporter Eric Tegetoff spoke with Janet Bauer of the Oregon Center for Public Policy about the struggle these families will continue to face.
We are talking about the plan to raise the minimum wage to $9.25 in 2015, about an increase of 15 cents. Do you think it's large enough to make a meaningful impact in this coming year?
Well, thank you. First, I should explain that the reason that Oregon's minimum wage is increasing by 15 cents is because Oregon voters approved a ballot measure to tie Oregon's minimum wage to the cost of cost of living increases. So what that means is that as expenses rise, so does Oregon's minimum wage. And this allows the purchasing power of low-wage workers to keep pace and not erode. So it plays an important role in providing a floor for low-wage workers. What it doesn't do is make any progress. And there's considerable ways that we can look at how Oregon's current minimum wage functions for low-wage families. First of all, Oregon's minimum wage in 2015 would not be enough to allow a family with a full-time minimum wage worker to rise out of poverty. So for that family, they're still facing extreme deprivation because the poverty level really represents a very low level of income and is not seen as an income sufficient to meet basic needs.
In your press release, you said that it would take at least a minimum of $11.70 to lift a family of four out of poverty.
The thing that's clear is that it's the poverty line, the income equivalent to the poverty line, is far below that needed for a household to meet their basic needs. In fact, it's an income level that would be less than half of what that family would need. So clearly the family is going to struggle with some of the major expenses that households typically face, such as rent, transportation, and childcare costs.
For KBOO News, this is Eric Tegedoff. I've been speaking with Janet Bauer, the policy analyst at Oregon Center for Public Policy.
The unemployment rate in Oregon is on the rise again, even though more people are getting jobs. But the increase in jobs is not keeping pace with the increase in population in the state. According to a report from the State Employment Department, the current unemployment rate in Oregon is 7%.
A lion cub in the Oregon Zoo was euthanized this week after the cub's mother apparently tried to kill her. Three other lion cubs are closely being monitored as they remain with their mother in the Oregon Zoo. While zoo officials claim that the injury to the cub may have been accidental, Brittany Pete, a Washington, D.C. lawyer who works with the group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, disagrees with the zoo's assessment. She spoke with KBOO's Jenica Soderberg about the problems faced by animals bred in captivity.
Is this something that happens frequently in zoos where animals will actually try to kill their own children?
Well, there are certainly many documented cases of this happening with lions, with polar bears, even with orcas in some cases. And when you think about it, lions and other wild animals roam far and wide in nature. Lions have a natural home range of hundreds of miles in the wild. They're able to seek out their own mates and companions in the wild and claim territory. And the very essence of these animals makes captivity a living hell for them. They're put into these unnatural situations, and they're denied everything that is natural and important to them. So that is why experts believe, while they don't know exactly what the cause is, it does appear that it is caused by unnatural stressors brought on by captivity.
Now, the zoo is claiming that they believe this was accidental and that the mother did not intend to harm the baby lion. What do you think are the chances that's the case?
Well, it's certainly possible, but because we've seen these situations happen before and we also know about other issues at the Oregon Zoo. There are elephants suffering from tuberculosis One of those elephants lost 1,400 pounds in 2 weeks not long ago. So there are serious questions about animal care at the Oregon Zoo that certainly raise questions about what happened that caused this lion cub to be euthanized.
Do you think that there is a way to keep animals in captivity in a humane way, or are zoos in and of themselves kind of by definition cruelty to animals?
Zoos can never truly recreate conditions in the wild. They can never allow animals like lions to have the huge natural ranges that they have and to be able to engage in natural behaviors. And so while there are, it is certainly preferable for captive animals who are being retired to be retired to true sanctuaries that can more accurately provide those sorts of conditions with, you know, much larger enclosures. And, you know, these are places who aren't seeking to exploit animals for profit. Those true sanctuaries are better, but we can never recreate the true conditions in the wild in captivity, and that's why it's completely inappropriate to keep animals like lions and elephants in captivity in the first place.
Well, thanks so much for that. Again, I've been speaking with Brittany Pete. She is a counsel with PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, based in Washington, D.C. This is Jenka Soderberg with...
As the Portland branch of Catholic Charities moves ahead with its plan to demolish St. Francis Park in southeast Portland to construct an apartment building, some local residents have organized to try and save the park. Ed Lyle spoke with KABU today about why he thinks the nonprofit organization should reconsider its plan to replace the park.
What are the people going to do to save the park?
Well, I guess a little bit of history is important. I heard that something was afoot about 2 years ago, that there might be some desire to sell the park on behalf of the parish, and I did not act on it. In the intervening period, nothing has happened, but in late July, I heard again that the deals were already signed and ready to go. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. Nobody asked me. The park was started 45 years ago. It was given with a handshake and a moral blessing from Sister Mary Louise Volk at St. Francis School, who is the nun in charge there. And she said, this weedy old playground of ours can do a lot better.
Right.
And so she gave it to the neighborhood.
And I also grew up in that. What are some of the ways people enjoy the park?
Well, I think that many people enjoy the park in different ways. I mean, it's such a varied space.
Yeah.
That there's a water feature, there's areas to just lounge, there's a children's playground area.
Right. And there's this pirate thing.
There is a pirate thing, a captain's head.
Right, yes.
Above the water.
Right,
pump.
Right. And. Yeah.
At one time, there was an extensive jungle gym.
Yes.
That went throughout the park. And over the few years, the last 20 years, things have changed and I think have been improved. The jungle gym, unfortunately, did go.
Oh, it, I'm sorry.
Well, it did scare a lot of people, a lot of parents. Yeah. There were a few actual broken bones, but I mean, the potential was there. And then because we were sensitive to the needs of the neighborhood, we had, of all people, the engineering corps of the U.S. Marine Corps and Marine Corps Reserve come in with heavy equipment, and they actually removed some of the berms and filled in some of the valleys and made it a little easier to look in.
What does Catholic Charities, what to put in place of the park?
Well, as far as I can tell right now, they're using about every buzzword that would appeal to liberals that they can. One is low-income housing,
wow,
or affordable housing, or working class housing.
Wow.
But it does come at a significant community cost.
Yes.
Their $21 million project for the whole thing is going to cost the city perhaps $6.5 million at the end of it.
Wow.
And very few people are opposed to Catholic Charities and to the good work that they have done, and I'm not. However, it's just this space. This space is the wrong space. It might be the right project, but it's the wrong space.
Ed, thank you so much for being here and for your work on this issue.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Cenk and Susan.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Cenk Soderberg with KBOO News.
And Susan Cecil.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the VU, followed by Occupy Portland Radio at 6. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy with a high of 77 and a low of 60. Today in history, in 1849, American abolitionist Harriet Tubman escaped from slavery. And in 1991, the first Linux kernel was released onto the internet. And in 2011, the Occupy Wall Street movement began with a gathering of more than 1,000 people at Zuccotti Park in New York City.
It's 5:26, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Who says we're not making progress in battling the senseless greed of corporate profiteers? Look at the big change won earlier this year when the labels on Johnson's baby shampoo announced improved formula. This popular Johnson & Johnson's baby product has long been advertised with the comforting slogan, "No more tears." For the shampoo's ingredients don't sting a tiny tot's eyes. That's nice, but many mommies and daddies have become more concerned about another ingredient the corporation has not advertised, formaldehyde. This toxic industrial chemical, which can cause several cancers and leukemia, is contained in thousands of consumer items, including carpets, nail polish, and, yes, soaps, lotions, wipes, and dozens of other baby products. But Johnson's improved baby shampoo qualifies for a new advertising slogan, now with no formaldehyde. You'll see no such bragging, however, for even though this is a big beneficial step for baby's health, the corporation continues to assert that the amount of poison in a bottle of shampoo is harmless. But as the head of the Environmental Working Group put it, why is there a carcinogen in their shampoo? When in doubt, take it out. Bingo. And let's note that J&J is not taking formaldehyde out as an act of corporate benevolence, but because a tenacious grassroots coalition called Campaign for Safe Cosmetics has rallied consumers, scientists, and family advocates to demand it. As Johnson's head of consumer product development conceded, this health concern lands right at the heart and soul of what Johnson & Johnson is all about, so we had to take this very seriously. This is Jim Hightower saying, such other giants as Revlon and L'Oreal, however, are not removing formaldehyde. So we must keep pushing. To help, go to Campaign for Safe Cosmetics at safecosmetics.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The police officer who shot and killed unarmed black teen Michael Brown testified at a grand jury today, which will determine whether criminal charges will be brought against him. Officer Darren Wilson appeared before the grand jury, and while the proceedings remain secret, a source told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that Wilson was cooperative. Wilson shot Brown on the afternoon of August 9th in an incident that witnesses and the Ferguson, Missouri police dispute. Multiple witnesses have said that Brown was shot with his hands in the air, while police have repeated that Wilson shot Brown after an altercation took place in Wilson's vehicle, and that Brown was charging towards Wilson when he was shot. Yesterday, it was announced that the grand jury investigating the shooting will be extended until January of 2015. St. Louis prosecuting attorney Bob McCulloch, who is overseeing the grand jury, said he will release audio from the proceedings in the event that no indictment is brought against Wilson. The shooting of Michael Brown touched off more than a week of protests, which were met with a militarized response by police. Yesterday, protesters packed a St. Louis City Council meeting to criticize Democratic Councilman Dan Stenger for what they say is his close relationship with McCulloch. Protesters have questioned McCulloch's impartiality in the matter, as they see he has a track record of deferring to law enforcement in similar cases. One protester who addressed the council told them they are like ISIS to black people, referring to the group the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria.
In related news, a Missouri teen is in a medically induced coma after being tasered after an altercation with police at a traffic stop. The incident took place in Independence, a suburb of Kansas City. 17-year-old Bryce Masters is suffering brain injuries after being tasered by Independence police officer Tim Reynolds. Witnesses said that shortly after Masters was stopped, they heard screaming. Masters is said to have been knocked unconscious with blood trickling from his nose after the encounter. Police have not released their account of the encounter, but have said Masters was tasered after he was uncooperative, and they said the use of the taser was within policy. The incident took place Sunday. The FBI, citing inconsistencies in the accounts of witnesses and police, is investigating the incident.
Star National Football League running back Adrian Peterson has been suspended indefinitely by his team, the Minnesota Vikings, due to his indictment for felony child abuse in Texas. Peterson sat out last week's game but had been cleared to return by his team. The move comes a day after team officials said that he would take the field until the outcome of his charge was resolved. Peterson was indicted for causing injury to a child after he allegedly struck his 4-year-old son repeatedly with a tree branch. The boy's injuries were severe enough to cause multiple abrasions on his loins, and the attack reportedly gave him scratches on his scrotum. The NFL has been embroiled in controversy this summer after high-profile incidents involving players committing domestic violence. Today it was announced that Greg Hardy, a Carolina Panthers defensive end, would also be suspended indefinitely by the league while he appeals a guilty verdict for domestic abuse. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell also said that he would not hear an appeal on the indefinite suspension of former Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice, who punched his then-fiancée in the face in an Atlantic City casino elevator this summer, an attack that was caught on tape.
Toronto Mayor Rob Ford has a rare and aggressive form of cancer, according to statements made by his doctor. Dr. Zane Cohen of Mount Sinai Hospital said Ford has a malignant sarcoma tumor in his abdomen and that he will need surgery and chemotherapy. Ford has been hospitalized for a week. Last week, the controversial mayor announced his illness and suspended a campaign for re-election. Ford had been doggedly pursuing re-election despite legal troubles, including the rumored existence of video showing him smoking crack cocaine. Ford's brother has announced he will run in his brother's place.
The West African country of Sierra Leone is on lockdown from Thursday until Sunday amid fears of the spreading Ebola epidemic. Citizens are required to stay at home during the lockdown. Health workers will be going house to house in order to identify cases and offer awareness about the disease, which has already claimed the lives of 2,500 people in the last 9 months. President Obama stated Tuesday that Ebola is a threat to global security. The president has ordered 3,000 troops to West Africa, though how the troops will help fight the outbreak is unclear. President Obama decided to send troops despite a request from the governments of the countries involved that health workers and equipment be sent instead of troops. This morning, the U.S. doctor Kent Brantley, who contracted Ebola while working in Liberia, spoke to House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee. He said response to the disease was slow until he and other American doctors contracted the disease.
To control this outbreak and save the lives of thousands of West Africans and possibly many Americans, we need the promised Ebola treatment units, the surge in healthcare workers, the U.S. Military Regional Command and Control Center, and we need it immediately. We also need the 400,000 home treatment kits that have been committed to be sent without delay. There's no time to waste if we are to contain Ebola and adequately care for the thousands of people that epidemiologists are now predicting will fall victim in just the next few weeks. The U.S. military must establish and maintain an air bridge to deliver critically needed personnel and medical supplies and to continue bringing in more resources in the future. We cannot turn the tide of this disease without regular flights of personnel and large cargo loads of equipment and supplies. I'm grateful to the President for his decision to send tens of thousands of Ebola test kits to the region, but these will only be helpful if we also deploy all available mobile laboratories and increase funding for more to be built as quickly as possible. During my time in Liberia, the laboratory we used to confirm Ebola virus infection in patients was 45 minutes away from our hospital, inadequately staffed. The turnaround time to positively identify an Ebola case was anywhere from 12 to 36 hours after the blood was drawn. If a patient is not infected with the virus, that can be a life-threatening delay. More kits are not effective unless we have the facilities and the staffing to use them. As the first human being to ever receive the experimental drug ZMapp, I am a strong advocate for the CDC and the NIH as they research vaccines and drugs, as we've just heard about. And these drugs can give patients hope for recovery. I'm deeply grateful to the personnel at MAP Biopharmaceuticals who, even before this outbreak, dedicated their lives to combating Ebola. We cannot wait, however, for a magic bullet to halt the spread of this virus in West Africa. The current epidemic is beyond anything we have seen before, and it's time to think outside the box. I realize that home health care interventions can be controversial. However, we know that many Ebola-positive people are staying at home and even hiding after they become infected. Because of fear and superstition, their families either abandon them or they lovingly care for them in ways that almost always result in infection of the caregivers. This is a major contributor to the spread of Ebola, and we cannot contain the disease without addressing this problem head on. Caregivers must be trained in safety measures and supplied with basic protective equipment so they can care for their loved ones while protecting themselves. As the number of survivors increases, these individuals should be mobilized to help educate and support their own communities. They would be a powerful witness that the disease is not 100% fatal, and they could provide much needed support to those who are trying to do what is best for their family members. Admittedly, home care is less ideal than treatment in an isolation unit. In the home, it's impossible to administer IV fluids and other supportive medical interventions. However, there are not enough beds in the Ebola treatment units right now, and many infected people are choosing to suffer and die at home. The least we can do is try to give their caregivers the information and resources they need to protect themselves from this deadly virus. All of these interventions that are needed to stop this horrendous transnational outbreak require significant funding, and budgets must be adjusted appropriately. This is not simply a matter of providing humanitarian aid. It is very much a national security concern. One of my patients in Liberia was a man named Francis. Like most patients, at first he was fearful. But eventually, he shared the story of how he contracted the disease. He said to me, "Doc, I remember who the man was that I got this infection from." He said he was sick at home and his condition worsened. And when he began vomiting blood, everyone around him fled. But his wife was determined to get him to the hospital. Since no one else was around to help, Francis went to this man's house and helped carry him out of the house and put him in a taxi. On the way to the hospital, that man died. If someone had come alongside Francis and given him a little bit of education and provided him with the personal protective equipment he needed, his family would still have their father and their son and their brother, and the world might still have this Good Samaritan. But unfortunately, Francis fell victim to Ebola and died. Many, including one of the senators today, use the analogy of a fire burning out of control to describe this unprecedented Ebola outbreak. Indeed, it is a fire. It is a fire straight from the pit of hell. We cannot fool ourselves into thinking that the vast moat of the Atlantic Ocean will protect us from the flames of this fire. Instead, we must move quickly and immediately to deliver the promises that have been made and to be open to practical, innovative interventions.
And that was Dr. Kent Brantley speaking in front of the U.S. Senate this morning. He's one of two American doctors who contracted Ebola while treating patients in West Africa.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, September 17th, 2014. Israeli settlers bulldoze Palestinian lands and troops invade West Bank communities and kidnap civilians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A number of extremist Israeli settlers bulldozed agricultural and grazing lands belonging to residents from Deir Istia and Haris village, north of the central West Bank city of Salfit. The settlers came from Ravava illegal Israeli settlement built on Palestinian lands in the district. The attack is part of Israel's effort to expand the illegal settlement on the expense of Palestinian lands belonging to residents of Deir Istia and Haris. In related news, the Israeli army on Wednesday seized privately owned Palestinian tractors and agricultural equipment in Arras al-Ahmar, a small village to the east of Tubas in northern West Bank. Soldiers stormed the village in the early morning hours, ordering farmers to produce their identity cards for them. The soldiers then seized their tractors and other equipment and took them to a nearby military outpost. Just a few days ago, the army seized water lines and irrigation networks in the area, according to the village mayor Bashar Ben Ouda. Elsewhere, hundreds of Israeli settlers again toured the site of Joseph's tomb in Nablus under guard of Israeli troops, leading to clashes with Palestinian protesters. Witnesses told local media that more than 30 military vehicles escorted 8 buses carrying Israelis. Israeli troops attacked angry residents using tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. Local youth responded by throwing stones and Molotov cocktails at the military vehicles as they drove near Balata and Askar refugee camps in Nablus. Earlier on Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers continued their daily invasions into different Palestinian communities and kidnapped 6 civilians, including 2 children, in the West Bank and Jerusalem. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, September 17th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bandura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, at least 49 Taliban fighters were killed and 15 others arrested during military operations by Afghan National Security Forces in the past 24 hours. The operations were jointly conducted by Afghan National Police, Afghan National Army, and Afghan Intelligence. In a separate incident, at least 2 civilians were killed and 3 others wounded in a roadside blast in Helmand Province on Tuesday. The incident occurred in Musa Qala, a district where a roadside mine hit a civilian vehicle, according to the district governor. 2 Americans were among 7 people killed in a massive car bomb near the U.S. Embassy in the Afghan capital on Tuesday, according to a U.S. military official. One of the U.S. citizens was a service member, the other a civilian, the official said. Earlier, the NATO-led coalition released a statement confirming 3 of its personnel died in the blast, which apparently targeted an international military convoy in Kabul.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Eric Tagetoff and David Lessem. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7000. 7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 o'clock, Lisa Loving, guest host Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. She welcomes guests from 15 Now PDX to talk about the fight for a $15 minimum wage in Oregon. At 9 o'clock is Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, with host Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Per Fagerin speaks with journalist Robert Perry about Ukraine. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, we hear an interview with Tamanian writer Richard Flanagan about his latest novel, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, which takes place in 1943 in a Japanese POW camp on the Thai-Burma Death Railway. And at 11:30, host Jean Bradley speaks with Doris Kearns Goodwin about her book, The Bully Pulpit, and how President Teddy Roosevelt effectively used the bully pulpit. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Time for KBOO News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer.
Yes, once again, it is time for News from the Boo, our weekly program, Wednesdays at 5:45-ish, where we hear from folks inside of KBOO about happenings inside of and around KBOO. Tonight, we'll be speaking with station co-manager Monica Beamer.
The phone lines are open, listeners, so if any of you would like to call in with a question or comment, we'd love to talk with you. The number is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Good evening, Monica.
Hello.
Hello.
So tell us a little bit about what's happening around KBOO.
Well, September is a very busy month, and we have a lot going on. Our fiscal year is ending September 30th, and a new year starting October 1st. So the staff are finishing up with our goals and objectives and budget for the year that's going to the board next week.
So how are things looking budget-wise?
It's still looking like we will break even financially for this current year. And that means our revenues and expenses will be very nearly the same for the first time in 4 years. And as one person pointed out recently, there are many ways to reach that goal, not all of them good. But while we still have a lot of room to go to restore some of the positions that we've lost over the past few years, we will break even this year after restoring two of the positions that had become part-time during cutbacks to full-time.
And what about 2015? How's the budget look for next year?
Well, as I mentioned, the board's voting on this and the work plans on Monday, but it's looking good. One exciting thing, there's money to support a new website and app, and also the goal of hiring a development coordinator to help restore some of the revenues to support the station.
How can people find out about goals that we have for 2015?
Once the goals and objectives are passed by the board, we'll put these on the website and report on them monthly. We have goals in 8 areas that are all, of course, interdependent: membership, development, messaging, tech, volunteer, programming, and finance, as well as Mike and I have station co-manager goals. Some of the exciting things to look forward to are connecting with Mike through photos, music and reflections from various countries in Africa as he goes on the African hip-hop caravan in November. That's exciting. We'll also formalize an internship program to provide more support to some key volunteer positions, as well as providing more support to the station. So we're developing a capital budget for equipment, facility maintenance, and replacement. Some mundane and some exciting stuff, but all very essential for budgeting and taking care of stuff. And we've been working on these for the past 3 or 4 months, so it's pretty exciting.
So we have a membership drive coming up fairly soon, is that correct?
Yes, October 1st through 11th. And we hope everyone received their sweepstakes letter in the mail last week. You can send in your fall membership donation with that letter and help shorten the drive. We'll carry over what we receive over the September goals to decrease the October drive goals in the days of the drive. Folks who do this are also entered into a drawing for a trip to Mexico with airfare.
Well, certainly good luck to everyone involved, though maybe not as much luck as to me. Just a reminder, this is News from the Boo, an inside look at what's happening at KBOO. We are here today with station co-manager Monica Beamer. The phone lines, once again, are open tonight. If you have any questions, now's the time to ask them. The number to call is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187.
KBOO's annual meeting is this weekend. Monica, why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, Saturday is our annual meeting and the counting of the ballots for the board candidates. And this will take place from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Lotus Seed on the corner of Northeast Tillamook and North Williams. And you can bring your ballot to that meeting, but it has to be in by 2 p.m. And folks can hear more about our candidates who have stepped up to this important role online as their interviews are archived on the website.
What else is going to be happening at the annual meeting?
We have some music, a great band, Bajo Solario Collective Band, who play what they call urgent music, which is new song, protest, folkloric, and Andean music with immigrant stories from their lives. And they'll play at 3 p.m. and soon after, keynote speaker, former mayor, and current executive director of the City Club of Portland, Sam Adams, will speak about the importance of KBOO and community engagement. Our current board president, Adin Rogovin, will give a state of the station address, and there will be food and mingling. Mike and I will be there, and we'll MC, and we're looking forward to meeting folks.
The Cascade Media Convergence is also this weekend, and the hackathon. Tell us about those.
Yes. Friday through Sunday is the Cascade Media Convergence that KBOO has been co-sponsoring and is presenting at. And the first ever Portland Open News Hackathon will take place at this weekend at the Convergence. The hackathon seeks to answer the question, how can we build software or other tools to help harness, verify, and prioritize news and information coming from members of our community, and has been developed by KBOO's news director, Jinka Soderberg. The vision's pretty cool. It's pretty much so everyday things that are happening in our community that neighbors and community members are witness to. And how do we discern fact from fiction, rumor from real news, and utilize a network of citizen reporters across the city and region to help in this effort? So how do we turn these tips into fully produced news stories that can be broadcast? The Open News Hackathon will be held all weekend, September 19th through 21st, as part of the Cascade Media Convergence, as we mentioned. And hackathoners will gather first on Saturday, September 20th at 9 a.m. to form teams, begin the design process, and then the teams will go through user scenarios, build prototypes, test design, and present their findings Sunday morning, September 21st. And the best design will be put into use in an actual newsroom setting, and people can continue to be involved as we evolve and build out the prototype into a working product over the coming months, so it's kind of exciting. The Convergence takes place at the Turnbull Building at the University of Oregon, located in downtown Portland at White Stag Building, which is 70 Northwest Cooch Street, September 19th through 21st. And Mike is also leading a musical benefit with Jabberwock, China Lucy, DJ Clavicle, and more good people on Saturday night as part of the Convergence. More on all this good stuff at www.kboo.fm.
Great. Well, let's switch gears a little bit for our last few minutes. Tell us about the book and record sale. How did we do?
We did good. It was amazing. There was so many books and records and other things. And we did well towards our goals. We had lots of people, steady streaming people. We had music, great DJs all day. And we raised about $3,500 on our goal of $5,000. So a little bit short, but our expenses were down. We partnered with the Volunteers of America, who gave us their space in exchange for underwriting, which worked well because we could store everything there. But really, thank you to everyone who worked really hard and also who donated things. It's a great event.
And were there any special treasures? I know last year there were some amazing comic books.
Yeah, I heard about the comic books. I know that one of our board members donated something like 30 years of yoga journal or something. So, nice. Yeah, that's kind of exciting.
So you never know what you're going to find.
Yeah.
Are there any other events that are upcoming that you want us to know about?
Yes. The last weekend in September is a very important event, the Pacific Northwest Social Forum at the Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. Folks are coming from across the region. We have a big van coming from Montana and from Seattle and a couple from Northern California. We're coming together to build a Pacific Northwest plan of action for social, economic, and climate justice. And it's just a really important event we've been working on for about 14 months. We're gonna have a concert on Friday night. This should be very exciting. Then Saturday, come together and Joanne Hardesty is going to be on a panel representing media, and then we're going to break into what are called People's Movement Assemblies for about 3.5 hours that are the basic building block for building our plan of action. And some of the PMAs, People's Movement Assemblies, are housing and homelessness that Ibrahim Mubarak and myself will facilitate, Palestine and Gaza, immigrant rights, mass incarceration, indigenous treaty rights. There's about 9 PMAs. So folks come together and work on vision in that area and work on strategy and then bring demands to the bigger group that we would like to ask each other. And out of that, we're going to build our plan of action. So it's pretty big and pretty historic, and we're pretty excited. It's coming together well.
How are how are the PMAs decided? If a participant wants to come and has something that they feel isn't addressed by the existing PMAs, is there a way to incorporate that, or can it be nominated for a future conference?
That's a great question. Self-organizing is really an important part of the U.S. Social Forum process, and so folks come and they're interested. We don't have any rooms left, but there's lots of space, and we can support folks in doing that if they can find some folks who are interested as well. So it's pretty exciting.
And if they want more details on that, where should they go?
Normally I would send them to the KBOO website, but I'm going to send them to the Pacific Northwest Social Forum website just because we want folks to register. And it's pnwsf.org.
And for other events besides this one, where can they go?
Well, as always, you can find out more at www.kbu.fm on the right-hand column under events. And as always, thank you to all the people who do so much for KBOO, members and volunteers and programmers. We're really grateful.
Any last-minute things that slip in?
Nope, just glad that September has been such a nice month. It's very busy, and hopefully Mike and I will get to come and do the News from the Boo together a little bit in the future.
We look forward to that.
Yeah, and we'll look forward to Mike's dispatches from Africa.
I'm excited.
That will be excellent. Well, that is News from the Boo for this week. We will see Mike or Monica, or Mike and Monica, next week again to discuss issues within and without KBOO. And we welcome your participation then. Thank you very much for joining us, Monica.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you later.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, Occupy Radio.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, Friday, September 19th through the 21st, at the University of Oregon Turnbull Center, 70 Northwest Coote Street in Portland. The goals of this Cascade Media Convergence are to create a space for media makers to network and share best practices, collectively learn skills, and lay the framework for continued collaboration and plant the seeds toward building a regional grassroots media coalition. There will be workshops, strategy sessions, and space and time for deeper discussions on all aspects of grassroots media. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence, September 19th through 21st, at the University of Oregon Turnbull Center, 70 Northwest Coote Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle Productions premiere of Tick Tick Boom, a play by Jonathan Larson. Tick Tick Boom is a three-chapter pop-rock musical about facing crossroads in life and holding on to your dreams that was first produced off-Broadway in 2001.